Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. A little over 25 years ago, my new bride and I decided on New England for our honeymoon. We were both fairly well-traveled, but somehow those states went unvisited until after our nuptials. It was a great time, of course. We got married in October, so need I say more about the scenery we encountered? We did a lot of the things that most couples do on honeymoons and vacations, finding great restaurants, sightseeing, and of course, Boston's Little Italy was like a place of pilgrimage for me. But I'm not sure how many other couples became enthralled with visiting the cemeteries we came across in the four states we discovered. We made it a special point to hit just about every one we could spot. While one can find many points of interest in graveyards here in Michigan, it's obvious that ones in Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont might have a leg up on us simply because, well, they are older, so to speak. How cool is it to see a memorial to someone born in the 1600s? And one thing that really caught our eye is a little icon on tombstones we saw so many of, a flying skull. Seriously. So when I learned that a new book was on the market entitled Speaking with the Dead in Early America, I knew it would be right up my alley, and I hope yours. So for the next half hour, we'll learn more about the burial customs, religious beliefs, and superstitions of our forebears from the book's author, Eric Seaman. And I promise I'll ask about the flying skulls. A little bit about our guest. Eric Seaman chairs the history department at the University of Buffalo. His fields of interest include early American history, history of colonial North America, the history of religion, social and cultural history, transnational history, history of death, and indigenous history. And the book we are discussing today is the winner of the 2020 Lawrence Levine Award from the Organization of American Historians for the best book in American cultural history. And finally, Professor Seaman does have somewhat of a local connection to us all, as he is an alum of the University of Michigan. So we welcome to Common Threads Professor Eric Seaman. Hello, Eric.
Hello, Fred. Thank you very much. That's a funny story you tell about your honeymoon, because my wife is also a historian, and she also loves graveyards. So everywhere we travel, we know the first place we're going to hit is the local cemetery.
That is so true. And we have not stopped looking, although I will say that New England, nothing has topped our New England graveyard pilgrimage.
That's right.
Yes. So what new information or analysis do you think you've offered with this book that might not have been unveiled by previous research?
I think the most important new finding in the book is the central role that the dead have played for Protestants since the Reformation. So a lot of historians have looked at the role of death within Protestantism and how Protestants have their burial customs and beliefs about death and heaven and things like that. But nobody's really paid attention to the relationship between the living and the dead. And that's because most historians have imagined that that relationship between the living and the dead ended with the Protestant Reformation, because the reformers in the early 16th century who started the Reformation were very much trying to end that relationship between the living and the dead. It was one of their big criticisms of Catholicism, was that people had a supposedly kind of magical relationship to the dead. So that's the newest thing in the book, is uncovering in all these different sources the centrality of the dead for Protestants in the period that I cover, from the Reformation in 1517 through the middle of the 19th century.
And that is clearly evident in the book. I was not aware that this is brand new information for historians, but it certainly makes sense after having read the book. So what did the Protestants surrender when they became Protestants, so to speak, and you know, we're talking about in early America, like in the 17th century, we're two or three generations from the time of the most noted reformers. What did they surrender by turning Protestant, and did they gain anything, do you think, that the Catholics did not have?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would just back up to the very beginning of the Reformation to talk about the differences between late medieval Catholicism and Protestantism as it emerged after Martin Luther and John Calvin set forth its most important ideas in the 16th century. So in late medieval Catholicism, one of the most important aspects of that religion was their belief in purgatory. And purgatory was imagined as a place, I'll say between heaven and hell, but it wasn't really thought of geographically so much that way, as just the place where really most souls went after death. It was only a very small number who went straight to hell or straight to heaven. The vast majority for medieval Catholics went to purgatory. And it was the thing that was so important about purgatory for late medieval Catholics was that it allowed for a continuing relationship between the living and the dead. So the souls in purgatory could benefit from the actions of the living. People were supposed to say prayers for the souls of their loved one who were in purgatory. And if they did that, it could shorten the amount of time that person spent in purgatory. They were supposed to pay priests to say masses for their loved ones, and that too could shorten the time. And there was a reciprocal relationship between the living and the dead. The dead in purgatory, those souls in purgatory, could likewise pray for and help the living. So for Catholics, there was this intense bond between the living and the dead, and that was a central part of the religion. And people, by all evidence, people really liked that. Ordinary people found that to be a very comforting and powerful part of the religion. And what happened when Martin Luther began thinking about the ideas that would later be called the Protestant Reformation, he really wanted to focus on God's omnipotence, the power of God. And so he felt that this idea that people on earth affecting how quickly a soul got to heaven, that that sort of took away from God's greatness and his power. And so the Protestants, following Martin Luther, eventually abolished purgatory. And the idea was that a soul would go either straight to heaven or straight to hell upon death, and that was the end of the story. And the living could have no say or no influence over that destination. If your child died, its soul was either going to heaven or hell. God had determined that before time. That's the doctrine of predestination. Then once a person had gone to that, once a person's soul had gone to either heaven or hell, there was no changing that. So getting back to your question about what a person gave up, in theory, a Protestant in the 16th and 17th century gave up that Catholic ability to affect the state of the soul of their loved ones after death. But as the book shows, that was more in theory, really, than in practice. So that was the theory that Martin Luther and John Calvin came up with, but there was a lot of slippage between that and the actual practice of ordinary Protestants.
You know, you just said something that I'd never encountered before, and I'm curious if it is still maintained in Catholic doctrine.
I certainly knew about the practice of praying for the poor souls in purgatory, as they say, and how that would affect their sentence there. But I never knew that the souls in purgatory could pray for those who were still living. And I'm curious if you know whether or not that is still maintained in the Catholic Church.
I actually don't know the answer to that. As someone whose specialty, goes up through the 19th century, I'm not sure in recent years the Catholic Church has been redefining hell more as an idea than an actual place. Things like that. I'm not certain about that specific aspect of purgatory.
Okay. I have plenty of people to ask. No problem. you say that purgatory came into vogue in the 12th century. Now, that surprised me. I thought that purgatory would be older than that. Can you give us some understanding of how it developed? And what was before purgatory? Was it more Protestant, if you will? Was it simply the heaven-hell paradigm, or were there no hard and solid dogmas on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, yeah, it's really the 13th century that the belief in purgatory really flowers. It had been postulated much earlier, in about the 6th century. And there are, older, ancient, pre-Judeo-Christian religions that posited a kind of third place. So in the ancient Near East, there are various kind of sort of trifold dichotomies of the afterlife. But in terms of Christianity, it was really first postulated in the 6th century, and so it was. An idea among Catholic theologians for a number of centuries, but it wasn't until the 13th century that that it was written about with greater specificity, was talked about as a place, and the punishments of purgatory described more fully. That's one of the things that people forget when they think about purgatory as a place between heaven and hell. If you think of heaven as, perfect bliss and hell as incredible torture, then people think, well, maybe purgatory is just like meh, it's just like boring or something like that. That's something my students will often imagine. But the term purgatory comes from purgation, or being purged by fire in particular. So the souls had to be cleansed by fire in purgatory to reach the state where they were pure enough to go to heaven. And so, that took an indeterminate amount of time. Nobody knew how long that was. They just knew that the actions of the living could shorten that amount of time, and thus the interest in praying for the dead and things like that. But in terms of whether it was like Protestantism, certainly before the 13th century, praying for the souls of the dead was not a central part of Catholicism. It was kind of a minor part, and only took off in the 13th century. And you can actually see that in the artwork of the period, where there's many more representations of purgatory and the tortures that would be encountered there, starting in the 13th century, than there had been previously.
And would you agree? Well, first of all, before I ask the question, I want to remind people that you're listening to WGVU. The name of the program is Common Threads, and I'm Fred Stella. With me today is Professor Eric Seaman. He is the author of the book that we're talking about today, Speaking with the Dead in Early America. I'm curious, with your research, would you say that the main reason that the Protestants don't have purgatory and the Catholics do is because of that inference of purgatory in the Book of Maccabees, which the Protestants do not see as wholly inspired?
That's part of it. The Protestant polemicists of the 16th century liked to say that purgatory was non-scriptural. But I think the more important thing is the point I made earlier about just the way purgatory doesn't fit with the idea of that Luther was working on of God's omnipotence and the salvation by faith alone. That is, salvation by God's grace alone. That the actions of the living don't affect the destination of their own souls. This is one of the hardest things to understand about early Protestantism that I spend a lot of time with my students trying to explain. This is the kind of central doctrine of Calvinism, that the actions of the living don't affect whether they're going to heaven or hell, because God has determined that before time. I think it's closer to that logic rather than specifically the scriptural question, although, you know, like you say, that was part of the Protestant polemic.
You offer an equation in the book: Catholic equals presence, Protestant equals absence. Could you explain that?
That's right. So that's something I've borrowed from Robert Orsi, the fantastic religious studies scholar at Northwestern University, who has his field of interest is 20th century U.S. Catholicism, but he writes more broadly about the theory of religions. And in a recent book called History and Presence, which I'd recommend to anybody, and he's such an engaging writer, so really anyone interested in the topic would gain from it. So in History and Presence, Orsi talks about how Catholicism and Protestantism have been seen as opposites in this particular category of absence versus presence. That is, Catholicism is the religion of presence, and Protestantism is the religion of absence. And what that refers most explicitly to is communion, where for Catholics, the bread and the wine are transformed into the literal body and blood of Christ. And for Protestants, the bread and wine are merely symbols of the body and blood and body and blood of Christ. So for Catholics, in the Eucharist, there is the actual presence of Christ. And for Protestants, it's symbolic. But elaborating from that, Orsi talks about how Catholicism has been seen, sometimes caricatured, as being a religion of many different spiritual presences other than just God and Christ, including saints, the Virgin Mary, and so on, and that Protestantism has sometimes been oversimplified as having none of that. It's people believe have relationships with God and Christ, and that's it. And that's why his work is so useful for me, because what I find again and again in the sources is ordinary Protestants having relationships with their deceased loved ones, and it's that presence of the dead that becomes so powerful for them. And by the last couple chapters of the book, by the 19th century, it becomes really a central part of Protestantism.
Now, I can't remember the context of this note that I made, how it relates to the rest of the book, the theme of your book, but I still find this fascinating, and so I'd like you to answer the question and then remind us how it fits into the book. You say that families got smaller, and that affection replaced patriarchal domination. Explain that to me. I find that to be fascinating. And first of all, how did families get smaller, and why did families get smaller? By that, by the how, I mean, what form of birth control or family planning would have been practiced back then, and why was there an ambition to have smaller families?
Yeah, so So let me, I'll just explain for your listeners for just a second that the book covers a big sweep of time, really three and a half centuries. And so one of the things that I'm always trying to do is provide context for the big historical changes that are happening in tandem with the religious changes that I'm talking about in the book. And so one of the big changes that happens over the course of in early America from the first European colonists in the early 17th century into the 19th century is, as one of the things, as you say, is the declining size of the family. That, now, that doesn't start happening until the late 18th century. We start seeing the first evidence of it more evidence of it early in the 19th century. It starts first among upper middle class town and urban dwelling Euro-Americans. And then it eventually will spread out to others. In terms of the how, birth control, there is some availability of things like condoms, but mostly it's about withdrawal and natural, what we might call natural family planning methods. And the numbers aren't that enormous in terms of the drop. We're talking about a drop from maybe, and here I'm trying to remember, but I would say maybe like 6.5 children per couple in 1750 to like 5 or something like that in the early part of the 19th century. So it's not a dramatic change from, gigantic colonial families to a model like today. That'll take much longer to happen. But it is significant. I think even more important than the sheer number, which as I suggest isn't that great, are the changing ideas about what the family should be. And that's happening again at the same time at the late 18th century into the early 19th century, again starting among white upper middle class town dwellers, and including women who are more educated. There's the rise in that same period of what are called female academies. So these are women who are getting more educated than they had been able to be in the past. And those families are spending much more emotional energy on bonds of affection within the family. The older model for the colonial period was a much more patriarchal model. The father's rule, father's will kind of dictated what happened in a family. And toward the end of the 18th century into the 19th, there's much more concern about affection between parents and children, less use of corporal punishment, more emphasis on romantic bonds between husbands and wives. And the significance of all this for the book is that there was just more emphasis on powerful bonds of affection between family members in the 19th century than there had been in the 17th century, which isn't to say that in the 17th century people didn't love their children, people didn't love their spouses, but it was of a different register, a less intense, fiery kind of emotions. And so, with that intensity of familial bonds in the 19th century, means that when people die, their family members are perhaps even more bereaved than they had been in the past. Certainly, they're more willing to express that bereavement in the written sources. So it's possible that in the colonial period, people felt intense grief and were much more likely, if they wrote in a diary at all, to write something very brief. Hannah died today, to my great grief. That might be the extent of it. Whereas in the 19th century, the culture is encouraging people to write about their grief for pages and pages. And those are the sources that I'm able to mine to find people talking about and remembering and even praying to the deceased.
You use the word in the book, thanatology, which I'd never come across before. And I'm curious, is that still a thing? Are you a thanatologist?
I guess by the definition I am. It comes from the Greek thanatos, meaning death, simply. And you may have heard the phrase eros and thanatos that Freud used, the connection between love and death.
Mm-hmm.
And a thanatologist is simply someone who studies death. And I've been studying death now for over 20 years, maybe 25 years at this point.
But
so I'm a thanatologist.
I'm guessing it's an archaic term. Like, can I go to college and get a degree in thanatology?
I don't think there are any degrees in thanatology these days, although plenty of interest in funeral science. And I always teach students. I do a big lecture class called Death in America. I teach that about every other year, and it usually attracts between 100 and 150 students. And I've always got a couple who are studying to go into mortuary science, and they can't get that degree at my university. They'll usually go somewhere else to get that that shorter certificate. But it is of interest still to students today, that's for sure.
I would imagine. Eric, we are down to the wire for this episode of Common Threads, but there's still so much to cover. And you know what? I didn't even get a chance to ask about the flying skulls. So you have to come back next week and we'll cover all of that.
Sounds good.
You're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Professor Eric Seaman from the University of Buffalo, and we're talking about his latest book, Speaking with the Dead in Early America. Please join us again next week here on Common Threads.